although some of his men most likely did, and what attempts were made by his officers to restrain them were too little, too late. But this reasoning is ultimately fragile. However much Sherman and some of his generals may have struggled that evening to put out the fires, some of his soldiers clearly helped inflame them. And when the troops marched into Columbia, there were no orders issued, as had been earlier in 1864, that any man engaging in arson would be shot on the spot. Like everything else his men touched, in the end, Columbia, but one more stop along the way in his campaign of plunder, was nearly leveled. Sherman himself explained that in his march, he inflicted an astonishing $100 million worth of damage, of which only $20 million was necessary, the rest being simply waste and destruction. "This may seem a hard species of warfare," he explained, "but it was the only way to bring home the sad realities of war." That it did. 2 weeks later, flushed with excitement, Sherman's men crossed state lines and marched into North Carolina, en route to Goldsboro. With boyish pride, the general boasted, "There was no place in the Confederacy safe against my Army of the West." But this smacked of idle bravado and a touch of bluster. In truth, it was now as if the Westerners were a different army and Sherman a different general. The looting and burning ended. Unlike in South Carolina, any soldier caught engaging in such behavior would be executed without trial. "Deal as moderately and fairly by North Carolinians as possible," he ordered. "And also, leave their families for us to feed and protect." Here in North Carolina, only war property was to be destroyed. And even that logic did not hold when it came to battlefields and men. In the days that followed, there were a number of little clashes with Johnston's men. Actually, they were surprisingly sharp ones, at Averysboro and Bentonville. Yet while the dilapidated rebels bravely harassed the now assembled Union force of 80,000 men, Sherman, almost inexplicably, went out of his way to limit the conflict. This was more than ironic. In 1864, he had once roared, "I've got Joe Johnston dead," wildly hammering his supper table until the dishes rattled, convinced he had finally gotten Johnston and gotten him good. But he hadn't. Later that night, in fact, he learned quite the opposite. One of his key lieutenants had failed to take the nearby railroad, Johnston's fortifications had been too strong, and Sherman's own cavalry had arrived too late. Even as Sherman was the artful flanker, he had slowly come to believe that Johnston was a sagacious and cunning defensive strategist. Across a chain of isolated hills, thick forests, and deep misty ravines, Sherman had been relentless, continually feinting and maneuvering against Johnston. But the Virginian, ever on cat's feet, fell back and back, repeatedly eluding him. In Sherman's words, Johnston turned the whole region into one vast fortress, and he likened their respective shadow boxing to one big Indian war. It so galled him that on most days, Sherman would wake up and habitually cry, "Now what is Joe Johnston's game?" But by March 21, 2 days before he occupied Goldsboro, the game was now surely Sherman's. "I can do no more than annoy him," Johnston told Davis. And Sherman, finally, had Johnston just where he wanted him. His men outnumbered the Confederates by more than 3-1, yet somehow he let Johnston's small and demoralized forces slip away. Why? One excuse was that he couldn't transport the wounded. But this is mere cant. Another was that Sherman mistakenly believed that Johnston had 40,000 men directly under his command, more than he wanted to fight. This is the more plausible explanation. For one thing, his own soldiers, cocky, hardened, lean men of the West, were themselves thoroughly worn. After 7 weeks of continuous, tough campaigning, their greatest of the war, they needed to be replenished and resupplied. And they were themselves sick of war, as Sherman later acknowledged. For another, despite his reputation, Sherman had little taste for direct combat, dismissing it as glory and all moonshine, even going as far as deriding the greatest battlefield successes as coming at the expense of dead and mangled bodies. All this naturally suggests the answer to one of the more fascinating questions of the war. How could a man so ruthless in battle suddenly become so generous in peace? And having outwitted and outmaneuvered his rivals, what made this gifted general offer so much to Johnston at Durham Station? The reality was, Sherman was a bit of a romantic. His feelings in combat were laced with sentimentality for the loser and respect for a valiant foe. Like Lincoln, his concept of magnanimity was one of his more endearing and important traits. To be sure, defeat had to precede conciliation. There was no way around it. But for Sherman, revenge afterward was unsoldierly, unmanly, and ultimately counterproductive. Particularly after meeting with Lincoln at City Point in late March, he was also thinking ahead to reunion. "When peace does come," he once said in all sincerity, "you may call on me for anything. Then I will share with you the last cracker." Which is, of course, what ultimately led to a sweeping Bennett House agreement with Johnston on April 19. But now that agreement had been repudiated by Washington. On April 24, then, for Sherman it was as if everything had changed and nothing had changed. Though confident that the war was nearly over, he remained terrified of guerrilla warfare and of general chaos. After Lincoln's murder, the feisty Ohioan felt sick and powerless. Watching the disorderly events in the capital as well as across the South, he tartly wondered who was left on this continent to give order and shape to the now disjointed elements of the government. And as the hours of the ultimatum dwindled and the uneasy stalemate with Johnston was crumbling, Sherman openly feared that events are drifting further into another civil and anarchical war. No matter. Under the strict orders of Johnston and Stanton, and with the watchful eye of U.S. Grant looking over his shoulder, Sherman had little choice but to be poised for one last terrible march of death, if not for weeks and months of lingering pursuit of rebels who would take him to the steep, rugged mountains of Georgia and beyond. Even Grant himself was no longer taking any chances. Before departing for Raleigh, and startlingly enough, without having told Sherman, the commanding general had already issued a single stern order: move Sheridan with his cavalry toward Greensboro as soon as possible. Send one corps of infantry also. It wouldn't be needed. One by one, the remaining Confederate generals would reciprocate the overtures of their northern counterparts. Call it the spirit of Appomattox, or Lincoln's River Queen doctrine, and bring calm, dignity, and sobriety to winding down the war. Above all, in peace as in war, it was once again Robert E. Lee's voice that would set the Confederate tone for continuing surrender. Aide toi, et bien, t'aidera. Help yourself, and God will help you. That was the inscription on the sword that Lee had worn to the Wilmer McLean house at Appomattox, and those words seemed to guide him now. It couldn't have been easy. Beyond the heartache of war and the heartbreak of the defeat of his proud army, his own familial possessions had been ransacked by the Union. The cherished family estate at Arlington, belonging to his wife and kept as a shrine to George Washington, had been converted into a national cemetery for Union dead, and was now dotted with little white tombstones. Another family estate, known as the White House, had been torched by Federal soldiers. A third, Roman Coke, had been so savage that there was not a single fence post standing. All told, 11,000 acres of prime Virginia land that he had owned now lay in the hands of the Yankees, permanently. So, after Appomattox, his spirit shattered, he mounted his horse and returned to Richmond, to 707 Franklin Street, to the rented red brick row house where an arthritic Mary Custis Lee had lived during the final year of the war. Lee's revolutionary lineage was as impeccable as any other American, North or South. And his wife was the step-great-granddaughter of George Washington, making them uniquely descendants of the first family. But now, he was not a citizen of anything. Lee was, to put it bluntly, stateless, a man in limbo, without a country, a paroled prisoner of war living in occupied territory that was no longer the Confederate capital, but not yet a Union state, and whose fate had yet to be decided by Northern authorities. Sunken, his white hair thinning, Lee never revealed in any depth what he felt in these days. If there was bitterness, he never showed it. If there was any hardening of the heart, it was difficult to discern. We do know he was depressed, sleeping late and often. We can only surmise that he may have felt like a broken man. But what was most remarkable about Lee was his determination to do his public duty, as he stressed the need for the South to take the painful step of signing the loyalty oath and submitting to the governance of the United States. And just as significant, and perhaps as fascinating about Lee's actions, is not simply what he did do, but what he chose not to do. Just hours before he made the difficult ride back into Richmond, Lincoln had finally succumbed to the bullet lodged in his head. But this could not have been Lee's greatest concern. Richmond must have been. The sight of the Confederate capital had to have wrenched his soul. He had gone to war for Virginia, my country, and its erstwhile capital was now a shambles, overflowing with refugees and beggars, and filled with scorched brick skeletons that hovered madly over rubble-filled streets. Nearly a third of central Richmond was so decimated that it would come to be known as the Burnt District. Lee was a passionate man, and an equally fervent nationalist. No sight in the world could have pained him as much as the scene he was witnessing, except for perhaps the actual surrender of his men. But at the news of Lincoln's death, Lee expressed not a single word of hate or bitterness at the fallen enemy commander-in-chief. Nor did he gloat. Instead, he later called it a crime that was unexampled, one of the most deplorable that could have occurred, and one that must be deprecated by every American. This was significant. The fact was, the slightest word from Lee, even a small veiled hint that could be misconstrued, could have done much to reignite Southern passions and breathe new life into the remaining Southern forces still at war. It could have prompted an unearthly guerrilla struggle. It certainly would have ensured organized chaos, and it would most certainly have legitimized ongoing discord. "You have only to blow the bugle," one of his colonels once said to him. So true. All of the Confederacy was looking to him for guidance. "It is the influence of one man which sways the people," noted one journalist. He was referring, of course, to Lee. Indeed, while the Union armies were masters of the principal cities, there were still holdouts. Across the Confederacy, clashes continued in Alabama and Tennessee, in North Carolina and Missouri, in Kentucky and Georgia, in Texas and Mississippi, and in Florida and the Indian Territory. They had little names and were little places and were fleeting, but all shared a central ingredient, the shooting and dying, and the war continued. Near Tuskegee, and Mount Pleasant, and Chapel Hill, and Patterson, and Germantown, and Taylorsville, and Barnesville, and Montpelier Springs, and Buzzard's Roost, and Howard's Gap, and Lynn Creek, and Munford Station, and Hendersonville, and Boonsville, and Fort Adams, and Boggy Depot, and Miami, and elsewhere. But as Lincoln's eyes closed in the early morning of April 15, Robert E. Lee, in a momentous decision, resisted any temptation to call on the Confederacy to take advantage of the Union's disarray and somehow press the chaos of the North to its advantage. He had had enough. In fact, he decidedly went in the other direction. One mid-April day, a young cavalry scout from Mosby's Rangers, who was considered one of the most daring of the Confederacy's cavalry spies, slipped into the city and made his way to a home where Lee happened to be visiting. He had a message from Mosby. What should the Rangers do? Surrender? Or fight on? "Go home," Lee bluntly told the young scout. "All you boys who fought with me," he added, "help to build up the shattered fortunes of our old state." Like Lincoln, whose embalmed body was now lying on public display, Lee was determined to look ahead, not backward. and that became Lee's tireless message. Later in the month, he consented to an interview with Thomas Cook, a reporter from the New York Herald. Interestingly, Lee had been maintaining a public silence, but it is noteworthy that he said yes to this request. The situation across the country was now volatile. Since Lincoln's assassination, the North was ablaze with fury at the South, hysteria was widespread, Jefferson Davis was still at large, calling for further resistance, and sporadic fighting was ongoing. The reporter said that the people of the North were interested in what Lee had to say about the current state of affairs. Lee, who throughout the war had assiduously read Northern papers and had always been keenly attuned to Northern opinion, had another idea. He knew that this was a means of talking to the South as well. In more than one way, the interview was extraordinary. Lee condemned the assassination of Lincoln in the strongest terms. Deplorable, beyond execration, a crime, unexampled. He celebrated the end of slavery. "I am rejoiced that slavery is abolished. The best men of the South have long been anxious to do away with this institution. Slavery is forever dead." And he predictably defended the Southern view that secession had not been unconstitutional. "It has remained unsettled until the present time. The war is destined to set it to rest." But most astonishing about this interview was this, where just weeks earlier, even days really, indeed, even at Appomattox, whenever Lee had said the country, he had meant the South. And whenever he said we, he had meant the Confederacy. But now, the reporter was struck by the degree to which Lee talked throughout, freely and noticeably, as a citizen of the United States. The South, Lee stressed, was anxious to get back into the Union and to peace. And then he promised to make any sacrifice or perform any honorable act that would tend to the restoration of peace. At this critical juncture, no words could have said more or meant more when spoken. One young man, upon taking the loyalty oath, was upbraided by his patriotic Southern father. "You have disgraced the family." The son noted that General Lee advised him to do it. "Oh," the father sighed, "that alters the case. Whatever General Lee says is all right." Just 1 week after surrendering his army, Lee reluctantly consented to being photographed by the famed photographer Matthew Brady. "How can I sit for a photograph with the eyes of the world upon me as they are today?" But sit he did. Appearing in simple military dress, though without his braids or sword, he stepped out onto his herringbone brickback porch as Brady carefully adjusted the plates. What resulted was one of the most famous, if not intriguing, pictures of all the war. Lee standing erect and proud, his hat in one hand, his other hanging by his side. Most arresting are his eyes, deep and dark, peering off into the distance. Lee biographer Douglas Southall Freeman sees in this photo a stern picture, with Lee's jaw strongly set and a shadow both of anguish and defiance lingering on his face. Another biographer sees the light of battle in his eyes, and sorrow and determination, and a man who has surrendered but is not defeated. But what is most captivating is the mystery of the photo. Lee is a man in limbo, disenfranchised, without an army, a country, a homeland. Look deeply enough and you see the eyes are staring off into another world, at what might have been. But the former commander, fatigued and depressed, was now dealing in facts. And the future. He may no longer have had an army, but he had his voice, which could set the tone of reconciliation in the tense days to come. He had seen the fateful picture of a chaotic Richmond all around him, itself a metaphor and disheartening reminder of the desolation spread across the Confederacy. He could scarcely stomach any more. Nor could he have relished another stampede by Sherman, this time through North Carolina. Having already rejected the idea of his army fighting on, in small roving bands, he now sought to forestall Johnston's men, and the rest of the extant armies, from doing so. On April 20, he sat at his desk and penned another communique to Jefferson Davis. He had already written a formal report of his final operations, losses, and surrender. Of course, he was now a vanquished general, so there was no compelling reason for him to write to Davis again. Nonetheless, that was exactly what he did. Interestingly enough, this, his last letter to the Confederate president, though cloaked in the guise of military analysis, was a supremely political act, even if he would have denied it as such. And an act of humanity. Lee took dead aim at Davis's proposed new phase of warfare. "A partisan war may be continued," he wrote, "and the hostilities protracted, causing individual suffering and the devastation of the country." But he continued, "I see no prospect by that means of achieving independence." Knowing that Davis was calling for a guerrilla war if all else failed, he in effect told Davis to think long and hard about his actions. "To save useless effusion of blood, I would recommend measures be taken for the suspension of hostilities and the restoration of peace." Lee could be a shrewd political operator when he so chose. He well knew that word of his letter would seep out into the rest of the Confederacy for all to see. In the ensuing days, it did. Meanwhile, on the run, Jefferson Davis would choose to ignore Lee's admonition. But not so with the other men who would matter just as much, the Confederate generals still remaining in the field. Most prominent of these was now, of course, Joe Johnston, who in the early morning of April 25 had just been ominously instructed by Davis to retreat and fight on. Hearing of this, Mary Chestnut wrote, "They say Johnston will not be caught as Lee was. He can retreat. That is his trade. Thoughts turn to Texas. You remember Davy Crockett's farewell to the Democratic Party? You are going to the devil. I am going to Texas." But Johnston made his own choice. He wasn't going to Georgia or Texas or anywhere. Instead, he ignored his president's orders and contacted Sherman for a third time. To be sure, if Sherman had overstepped his bounds, Johnston would now more than outdo his partner with this out-and-out act of insubordination. Johnston was, in effect, willfully ignoring the edict of the Confederate president. He himself would later acknowledge that he directly disobeyed his instructions. Quite true. But Johnston, who wired back to Davis that such a plan of retreat was impracticable, saw no other way. In his view, it would be the greatest of crimes for us to attempt to continue the war. And making peace was the only function of the Confederate government still in existence. Moreover, to fight any further would only spread ruin all over the South. Nor did he share the notion of the unrepentant fire-eaters that no suffering which can be inflicted by the passage over our country of the Yankee armies can equal what would fall on us if we return to the Union. There is a vivid paradox to all this. Johnston, then and now, was derided by many as a retreatant Joe, a second-rate general, a near incompetent. Compact and fastidiously dressed, he had a sharp eye, a thin skin, and an inflated sense of honor, and he was known in the antebellum South as a crack shot in duck hunting who, in Mary Chestnut's words, never pulled the trigger. So too in war. Even for those who point to his flashes of tactical cunning, and they were there, and those who see him as a resolute and tactically ingenious army commander, in the larger flow of history what ultimately must stand out is not Johnston's military ability or his daring in battle, but this one decisive act in which he brazenly violated the chain of command, and in doing so, helped heal a country. It happened rather simply. Johnston immediately contacted Sherman and arranged for a third meeting, again at the Bennett farmhouse, to conclude a surrender on the basis of the revised terms. Sherman himself would later assert that Johnston was powerless to resist him. This, of course, was not quite true, but likely, Johnston did not see honor in further resistance, only tragedy and sorrow. He followed Lee's lead. Johnston and Sherman met on April 26, And this time, the two men, who would never meet again but would become lifetime admirers of each other, quickly disposed of the matter. Like Grant before him, Sherman offered concrete assistance to the Confederates, issuing 10 days' rations for 25,000 paroled rebels. The intent, as he noted, was to facilitate what you and I and all good men desire, the return to their homes of the officers and men composing your army. In an unmistakable act of small but touching symbolism, Sherman then graciously allowed Johnston's name to go first in the Articles of Surrender. Grant later reversed them so that Sherman's name would come first when they were published in the Northern press. Moreover, Sherman's field orders went out to encourage the inhabitants to renew their peaceful pursuits and to restore relations of friendship among our fellow citizens and countrymen. One good gesture would beget another. Johnston would later note that United States troops, remaining on military duty, treated the Southerners as kindly as they would those of Ohio or New York. And in turn, he would write to Sherman 2 days later, "The enlarged patriotism exhibited in your orders reconciles me to what I have previously regarded as the misfortune of my life, that of having to encounter you in the field." To his own men, Johnston enjoined them to observe faithfully the terms of pacification agreed upon, and to discharge the obligations of good and peaceful citizens. By such a course, you will best secure the comfort of your families and kindred, and restore tranquility to our country. Our country. In bits and pieces, this phrase was again slowly coming to mean North and South, one and the same. By now, the combined impact of Lee's and Johnston's surrenders was profound. As word spread of Johnston's actions, individual Confederate commanders and their Union adversaries quickly followed suit, making peace on the model established by Grant and Lee and reiterated by Sherman and Johnston. There was, in the end, no grand sweeping Congress of Vienna, just military man to military man, forging simple truces with a shake of a hand and the scratch of a pen. Following in their footsteps in the Western Theater was General Richard Taylor, commander of the Confederate Army, now about 10,000 strong in Alabama, Mississippi, and East Louisiana. Hardly enough men to pose a major threat, but more than enough to make mischief for years had he so desired. In a small but touching ceremony, Taylor, a short, articulate, dark-complexioned man, educated at Yale, Harvard, and Edinburgh, Scotland, surrendered to Major General Edward Canby in Citronelle, Alabama, on May 4. 2 days earlier, these men had themselves bonded, much like Lee and Grant, and Sherman and Johnston, sharing an al fresco luncheon topped off with rich pâtés and a number of bottles of champagne. "The first agreeable explosive sounds I had heard in years," Taylor drawled. When the band struck up "Hail Columbia," Canby hastily ordered a quick switch to Dixie, lest Taylor be offended. He wasn't. Not to be outclassed, in fine Southern style, the only son of a U.S. president to fight in the war requested, indeed, no doubt insisted, that the original tune continue. Evidently, as Shelby footnotes, the moment had once again come when they could hail Columbia together. Taylor, among the most literate of the generals, Union or Confederate, later commended his counterpart for his intellect and candid bearing, which entitled him to our highest respect and confidence. And he, too, sounded the call that his brave rebels should now meet their responsibilities, not simply as soldiers, but just as critically as good citizens. So with loose rocks do avalanches begin. The concept of citizens would come to mean much if the country were to become one again. But for the hard-fighting, never-surrendering Nathan Bedford Forrest, now camped out around Gainesville, Alabama, on the surface, no word could have seemed more alien. Well into late April, nothing rankled this grizzled cavalryman more than the thought of giving up. As he waited for more definitive word about the status of Lee and Johnston, and also Taylor, he toyed with the notion of going to Mexico. but then the news eventually filtered deep into the backwoods that Lee had in fact surrendered, as had Johnston. When Taylor followed suit on May 4, Forrest saddled up his horse and took off on a night ride with an aide to mull over his options. What should he do? Take to the hills? Mexico? Surrender? At one point, they cantered over to a fork in the road and came to a sudden halt. Their exchange is immortal. Which way, General? The aide asked. Either, Forrest growled. If one road led to hell and the other to Mexico, I would be indifferent which to take. In truth, he wasn't. Under the stars, Forrest, the villainous self-made millionaire who by now had lost everything, talked candidly with his adjutant. Among other things, he considered his responsibilities to his men and to the South. With the same elan and spirit that he had used to lead his cavalry into death-defying battle, he decided that he could lead them into peace. He agreed to lay down his arms and to abide by the terms that General Taylor had already agreed to. Thus, in early May, when the Mississippi governor and former governor of Tennessee rode out and urged Forrest to retreat with his cavalry to the Trans-Mississippi Theater, Forrest barked back, "Any man who is in favor of further prosecution of this war is a fit subject for a lunatic asylum." On May 9, Forrest dramatically announced to his riders that they would not take to the woods or the hills. They would not go to Mexico. They would not fight any further. Instead, they should surrender. As always, they followed. The attempt to establish a separate and independent Confederacy had failed, Forrest noted, and they should meet their responsibilities like men. He added, in some ways almost uncharacteristically, "Reason dictates and humanity demands that no more blood be shed." And of the North's demands, he said this, "The terms manifest a spirit of magnanimity and liberality on the part of the federal authorities, which should be met on our part by a faithful compliance with all the stipulations and conditions therein." He acknowledged rather candidly that civil war, such as you have just passed through, naturally engenders feelings of animosity, hatred, and revenge. To which he sharply counseled, "It is our duty to divest ourselves of all such feelings, and to cultivate feelings toward those with whom we have so long contested and so widely but honestly differed." Then Forrest took one final step that would long surprise many in the North, including his old adversary Sherman. Echoing the sentiments of Lee before him, in places almost word for word, he added, "I have never on the field of battle sent you where I was unwilling to go myself, nor would I advise you to a course which I felt myself unwilling to pursue. You have been good soldiers. You can be good citizens. Obey the laws, preserve your honor, and the government to which you have surrendered can afford to be and will be magnanimous." The other principal Confederate forces gave up the fight as well. Learning of Lee's capitulation, partisan hero John Mosby had already disbanded his Rangers on April 21, although he personally vowed to fight on. While racing to join Johnston in North Carolina, he received the heart-stopping news of the Bennett House surrender, at which point he finally called it quits. By month's end, in May, the ever-defiant General E. Kirby Smith followed suit, capitulating his ranks, some 36,000 weary troops that composed the Trans-Mississippi Department. Colonel J.Q. Chenoweth, commander of the Department of Western Kentucky, similarly surrendered. Major General Sam Jones, commander of the District of Florida, did likewise. His Union counterpart noting that he would do all in my power to make arrangements such as are honorable to brave enemies and generous foes. So did the eccentric and brilliant Confederate Brigadier General M. Jeff Thompson, leader of the rebel veterans in Missouri and the West. And last but not least, a month later, Brigadier General Stand Waddy, a.k.a. Degataga, the Cherokee chief, close to 60 years old, weather-beaten and bow-legged, his gray mane of hair fanning out over his shoulders, who had participated in almost 24 major battles and 100 smaller skirmishes, became the final Confederate general to lay down his arms. On June 23, 1865, he surrendered his battalion, a diverse amalgam of Confederate Cherokees, Creeks, Seminoles, and Osages, at Doakesville, the Choctaw capital near Fort Towson in Indian Territory. "We are falling to pieces," an aide to Jefferson Davis said ruefully on April 26, when word of Johnston's surrender came in. As an exhausted but still defiant Confederate president fled southward and westward, hoping somehow to rally the Confederacy from a new base in Texas, never were truer words spoken. Since the fall of Richmond, Davis's skeletal government had been on the run. 12 railroad cars, stuffed to the gills, a government on wheels clanking from one makeshift provisional capital to the next. Danville, Virginia, then Charlotte, North Carolina, then Abbeville, South Carolina, then Irwinville, Georgia. At each step of the way, the Confederate president had done everything in his power to ignite the waning Southern heart, but now it was to no avail. One by one, his generals had deserted him, following the example of Robert E. Lee and the inexorable call of military logic rather than the exhortations of their now quixotic president. In the end, Davis was the last remaining symbol of a dying Confederacy. And that was, to many who knew him, a particular kind of tragedy, even irony. In 1861, when the delegates of the seceding states had met in Montgomery to cheering crowds in the tune of Dixie to elect a new president of the Confederate States of America, the verdict was unanimous. Jefferson Davis. Here was a man brave enough and seasoned enough to lead them to victory. Out came the cry, "The man and the hour have met." Yet Davis wasn't even there. He was back in Mississippi with his wife, Verena, pruning rose bushes in the garden of his plantation, Briarfield. In truth, he was dismayed upon learning of the results. He had neither sought the chief office, nor did he want it. He had actually hoped for high command in the Confederate Army. Davis was never one to thrive on the eternal round of banquets, rallies, torchlight parades, and wakes that were the province of every politician, North or South. Nor was he a congenital handshaker, a backslapper, or a ready compromiser. "His genius was military," wrote Verena, "but as a party manager, he would not succeed. He did not know the arts of the politician and would not practice them if understood." But it was his high sense of duty and destiny that moved him reluctantly to accept. And now, having been there at the birth, he was there at the Confederacy's imminent death, resistant, unswerving, unrepentant, fervent, and unapologetic to the very end. The beginning was quite different. Like Abe Lincoln, Davis was born in a Kentucky log cabin on June 3, 1808, 8 months before the Union president, and less than 100 miles away. His father soon moved his family to the Mississippi cotton kingdom and prospered. Though to an extent Davis bore the familiar stamp of the South, the image of the exacting man ruled by self-control, the picture of the old-fashioned Southern gentleman, the portrait of the florid but uncaring slave owner, in his case this is often misleading. In countless ways, this icon of the South was surprisingly progressive, forward-looking, even cosmopolitan. His middle name was a whimsical Finis, because he was born when his mother was 45, the last of 10. His upbringing was astonishingly modern. His father, though austere, eschewed all forms of corporal punishment, and Davis was fussed over by big sisters. They called him Little Jeffy, and taught riding by doting older brothers. Reared a Baptist, he bore an un-Southern-like recalcitrance toward religion, and only much later, during the Civil War, converted to Episcopalianism. Educated by Roman Catholic Dominican friars, he was raised without prejudice against any sect, and, like Lincoln, he violently opposed the anti-Catholic crusade of the nativists and know-nothings during the 1840s and 1850s. His patriotism was unqualified and absolute. It was a lesson he learned at his father's knee, but not the only one. He was also impressively well-educated and well-read, attending the nationally famous Transylvania University in Lexington, Kentucky, at the tender age of 15. Transylvania then had a reputation that rivaled Harvard's. Thomas Jefferson would write, "We must send our children for education to Kentucky, Transylvania," and an enrollment that was even larger. Then, in accord with the wishes of his father, who died a year later, Davis went to West Point, where he graduated 23rd in a class of 33. His mediocre standing had less to do with his ability and more to do with the fact that he was a bit of a hellraiser. Though sturdy discipline was the rule, he often flaunted it. In his first year, as a plebe, he was charged for violating the prohibition against drinking at Benny Haven's Tavern, and that was just the beginning. Subsequently, he received demerits for spitting on the floor, for sloppy quarters, for long hair during inspection, for visiting during study hours, for absences during reveille, for absences from class and from the evening parade, for firing his musket out his dormitory window, for disobeying orders and using spirituous liquors, for refusing to march from mess hall, for cooking in his quarters after 8 p.m., and for foul clothes not in clothes bag. But his class standing and raucous behavior belied an active mind. He knew both Greek and Latin, and could read them in the original. He had a serviceable command of French. He was a self-styled Spanish scholar. He read Virgil, Burns, and Scott, and he loved poetry, memorizing Moore's Lalla Rookh and Byron's Don Juan. As a frontier officer, he fought bravely and well, fighting the Indians and personally transporting the captured Indian warrior, Black Hawk. From there, he went on to marry the daughter of General Zachary Taylor. By now, however, his military career had already been checkered by continuing rows, a contentious court-martial, and frustration over slow promotion, and Taylor himself had reservations about his daughter embracing the rough, dull life of a soldier's companion. So Davis left the army, but his beloved wife died 3 months later of malaria. He almost did too, and it broke his heart. For 8 lonely years, he lived in morbid seclusion as a planter at Briarfield, a modest 800-acre plantation near Vicksburg, Mississippi, lent to him by his older brother, Joseph. When it came to slaves, Davis was anything but a stereotypical Southerner. He was, to be sure, a firm believer in the Southern slave system, but he genuinely saw it as a benevolent institution. In a sense, this was less an example of self-delusion, though it was also some of that, than of self-indoctrination, born out of parochialism and his own laudable personal experience. For many years, he retained not a cruel white overseer, but a black overseer, Jim Pemberton, a faithful slave left to him by his father. Pemberton had once nursed Davis back to health after a dangerous bout with pneumonia, and Davis never forgot it. He loved him like a brother and treated him largely as an equal, and also as a friend. Davis even shared his cigars with Pemberton. By all accounts, with the rest of his slaves, he was a kind, paternalistic master. Reportedly, when rules were broken, it was solely by a slave jury that punishments were handed out, and Davis reserved for himself only the right to commute or lessen any sentence he deemed overly harsh, or to pardon the offender altogether. His slaves were never flogged. Families were kept together. The sick and the elderly were cared for, and there was no miscegenation. "Them Davises never let nobody touch one of their niggers," said one. "We had good grub and good clothes, and nobody worked hard," testified another. Davis made a point of treating his slaves with extreme courtesy, especially, but not only Pemberton, and equally made a point of returning any salute from a black, giving him an elaborate bow or a friendly shake of the hand. Neighboring plantation owners sniffed that the slaves at Briarfield were spoiled. But Davis also assumed, wrongly, that the treatment of slaves at Briarfield was commonplace. He refused to believe accounts of cruelty, dismissing them as the meddling handiwork of abolitionist fanatics or simply as northern malice. It never occurred to Davis that both could be true. By Southern standards, he was often liberal and astonishingly idealistic. Much like Lincoln and Thomas Jefferson, he did not believe slavery was the black's permanent condition, although he did insist that it would take several generations before it would be wise and practical to emancipate them. "The slave," he said, "must be made unfit for slavery and must be made fit for his freedom by education and discipline." But unlike Lincoln, he could never quite carry his convictions to their inexorable political conclusion. Although, of course, there were his conscription measures in the waning months and days of the war, of calling for any kind of an end to the institution. Indeed, he embraced it fully and totally. Thus, he believed that the Southern case for slavery and its extension rested on firm constitutional and moral foundations, seeing the limitations that the North sought to impose on slavery less as a deafening ethical question to be wrestled with and more as a naked grab for influence between the two sections. "The mask is off. The question is before us," he once memorably thundered. "It is a struggle for political power." In 1845, he remarried, choosing the tall, stately brunette Verena Howell of Natchez, who was herself a bit of a rarity in the antebellum South. Though her family had little in the way of wealth or pedigree, she was unusually well-educated for a Southern girl of that time, having been thoroughly tutored in the Greek and Latin classics for 12 years. Filled with wit and insight, what she lacked in fine Southern ancestry, she made up for in Northern blood. Her Whig grandfather had been governor of New Jersey. "Would you believe it?" she wrote her mother on first meeting her future husband. "He is refined and cultivated, and yet he is a Democrat." That he was, and he cut quite a figure in Southern political and social circles. Though the Davis family lacked a coat of arms and an aristocratic pedigree, and were only second-generation Southerners, Jefferson Davis had blue-blooded manners and high-minded tastes and values. Tall, slim, dramatically handsome, and often saturnine, he had deep-set gray-blue eyes and a sweet musical Southern voice with great rhetorical power. His political career was soon off and running when he won a spot in the U.S. House of Representatives. But his tenure was punctuated by the Mexican War, during which he was elected to the rank of colonel and served under his former father-in-law. Commanding a volunteer regiment, the Mississippi Rifles, he saw action at Monterey and then helped win the decisive Battle of Buena Vista by drawing his small force into a pincer and breaking the exquisitely outfitted Mexican cavalry charge. It was a turning point of the conflict and a turning point in his life. Davis emerged from the war a national hero and was labeled the best volunteer officer in the Army. President Polk offered him a general's commission, but because he had been badly wounded in the foot at Buena Vista, he turned it down. Instead, he chose to be nominated to the Senate. His yin of war had met his yang of politics, but there was little harmony. Politics suited him, yet only to a point, even though he initially earned considerable success. Christened the Gamecock of the South, he took his seat in the Senate, where he was now in the company of such mighty orators and legislative lions as Clay and Webster and his personal hero, John Calhoun. With his erudition and sonorous Southern voice, Davis delivered stem-winding, off-the-cuff speeches that quickly earned him the respect of his colleagues and the attention of the country. And as a fierce proponent of Southern rights and states' rights, he also earned the sobriquet Calhoun of Mississippi. For a Southerner, of course, there was no greater compliment. When the old fire-eater died in 1850, it was natural that Davis assumed his mantle, becoming the South's leading spokesman. But for Davis the politician, there was always a built-in tension that he could never easily reconcile. Austere, able, experienced, incorruptible, he had an abiding dislike of the give and take of politics. Privately, he could be warm and cordial. Socially, he could be quite pleasant, even charming. But on the floor of the Senate or in committee dealings, he was saddled with an aloof and obstinate streak. Sam Houston, the Texas governor, thought him cold as a lizard. Once, when a Senate colleague had simply wondered if he would perhaps vote for an appropriations bill, Davis snapped, "Sir, I make no terms. I accept no compromises." Where Lincoln had the common touch and even the keen sense of the ridiculous so necessary to the art of politics, Davis was saddled with a dominant streak of self-righteousness. Deep within him lurked a dark, insatiable, stubborn vein. This flaw, and it was a flaw, meant that once he made up his mind and adopted a position, he treated virtually any attempt to argue him out of it as an assault on his integrity. For this reason, he was perhaps temperamentally better suited to senatorial oration or a military career than to the gritty political necessities of a chief executive, a view that he privately seemed to share. It was understandable, then, that 15 months after leaving the Senate in a failed gubernatorial bid, he accepted the offer of his good friend, President Franklin Pierce, to be his Secretary of War, an office in which Davis became the most powerful voice in the cabinet and a forceful administrator. As War Secretary, he displayed great knowledge, considerable foresight, and an innovative spirit. He introduced the mini-ball and experimented with breech-loading rifles. He also introduced the Camel Corps to the Western frontier. They traveled twice as fast as horses, ate less, and could go for 3 days without water while carrying heavier loads. But his weaknesses then were self-evident. He got into unnecessary, even trivial, quarrels with his general-in-chief, Winfield Scott. He was a regular bulldog when he formed an opinion, for he would never let go, noted one of his clerks. Always a furnace of emotions, his inability to differentiate between passing glances and fatal blows would be an omen of things to come. Yet like the dog chasing a fly, he returned to politics, back to the Senate. In a number of ways, too often little noted, here again Davis was quite advanced for his time and place. He strongly supported the Transcontinental Railroad, territorial expansion, and free trade. John Quincy Adams, a staunch abolitionist, even warmly praised him for helping to set up the Smithsonian. And unlike many of his colleagues, Davis was acutely aware of the South's weaknesses, especially its lack of industry. In the 1850s, he also urged the South to build up its railroads, to foster greater immigration, and to provide greater state support for higher education. But in each of these cases, he acted as he did because he was an unswerving Southern nationalist. Herein, too, lay the dilemma of Jefferson Davis. He took a progressive line on just about everything. That is, everything except the intertwining issues of Southern rights, states' rights, and slavery. And in this sense, he was bound by the Procrustean chains of his Southern environs. As his career advanced, so too did his unwavering devotion to the unlimited expansion of slavery, and an equally unwavering devotion to Southern heritage. For this reason, he was ultimately a tragic, even confused creature of historical circumstance. Progressive on a host of issues, he was inflexible and dogmatic on one of the greatest issues of his time, slavery. No great believer in the racist theories undergirding slavery, he stoutly defended the institution. A fervent lover of his country, he loved his region even more. A believer in education, he was determined to wall off Northern ideas. He opposed secession, working tirelessly to find common ground between radicals on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line, yet he battled for the extreme claims of the South. A man with a deep humanitarian nature who treated slaves like family, he was woefully blind to the evils of the institution, and immensely talented in the craft of war, he repeatedly gravitated to, or was thrust or drafted into, politics. Which meant, of course, the presidency of the Confederate States of America. By 1861, he was a sickly man, having suffered from malaria, pneumonia, habitual facial pains, stinging chronic pain from his war wound, severe earaches, an inflamed red eye, and eyesight that was permanently impaired by prolonged exposure to the blinding snows of the western frontier. Throughout the war, these conditions only dangerously worsened. To the very end, he was frail, gaunt, agitated, and dyspeptic, with a recurring facial tic, a legacy of the neuralgia that would eventually render him blind in one eye. His physical condition was, of course, one matter, his leadership the other. Was he equal to the challenge? While many scholars think not, in truth, the picture is often more mixed. Photographs of Davis at the time neatly capture him. Thin-lipped, long-nosed, eyes hooded, the expression forbidding. When he should have been leading, Davis was instead engaged in too many endless quarrels, feuding heedlessly with Joe Johnston and Robert Toombs and Vice President Alexander Stevens and Texas Senator Wigfall and Governor Joseph Brown. His executive management was poor. He never really could decide whether he wanted to be president or secretary of war, and in often seeking to do both, it could be argued he did neither well. He lacked the necessary art of persuasion. Lincoln had to use the veto only 3 times, and in each case it stuck, while Davis vetoed 38 bills, and all but one was later passed by the Confederate Congress. He was frequently ill, or short-tempered, or autocratic. Some thought him a dictator. And for all his expertise in military affairs, he couldn't make up his mind on what strategy the South should pursue. Should it be offensive or defensive? On the one hand, he generally embraced a strategy like that of George Washington in the Revolution, who defended the nation from conquest and who won by not losing. This meant repeatedly trading space for time, retreating when attacked, avoiding full-scale battles that imperiled his own forces, and counterattacking only when such assault heralded success. In short, a strategy of attrition, wearing out a better-equipped and far more numerous adversary by compelling him to give up simply by making the war too costly. Yet Davis undercut his own instincts, taking much too seriously his pledge to protect every inch of Confederate soil, thus unwisely dispersing his forces instead of concentrating his smaller numbers of men in more discreetly defined areas. Nor did he successfully subdue the hue and cry of Confederate politicians to go on the offensive, to aggressively bring the war to the Yankees, even though it often meant that such bloody victories would ultimately be Pyrrhic ones. In the end, this was one matter where his dogmatism might have served him well, had he stubbornly clung to his own ideas about war fighting. Instead, here he acted too much like a politician, splitting the difference, with his offensive-defensive strategy. The strategy in itself was a sensible one, or at least could have been. But because it was never comprehensively or fully thought out, it was applied piecemeal. As a result, the South paid dearly. Without doubt, his task was an immense one. Born out of conflict, the Confederate nation was riven by rancorous factions, endless bitter disputes, and savage feuding. The striking lack of political parties meant that Davis had no organized structure with which to cultivate discipline or institutionalized loyalty, which, by comparison, had served Lincoln so well. It cost Davis. A martyr to his own ideology of states' rights, the Confederacy was also saddled with a political system wholly unsuited to the grim challenge of total war. A case in point. Each state at first raised its own forces and decided when and where they were to be used and who commanded them. For far too many of the South's leaders, the rights of their states were more important than the Confederacy itself. In this regard, the Confederacy went on to repeat many of the mistakes of the early American Republic to which it looked for inspiration. Men from one state at times resisted serving under a general from another. Some even disliked leaving their own states to fight. Commanders with troops from various states had to negotiate with the states themselves to get more men. The general government repeatedly wrangled with the state governments, and so on, with melancholy regularity. Davis accordingly had to contend with many of the struggles, over men, over money, over supplies, that nearly ruined George Washington in the 1770s. Significantly, like the founders before him, he only slowly understood the need for a serious federal element to work hand in hand with states' rights in waging a war. As the conflict progressed, Davis increasingly came to embrace the basic tenets of a centralized national state that had been so anathema to Confederate ideology. National draft laws, impressment, habeas corpus suspension, centralized economic management, and confiscatory taxation. But by then, it would be too late. Yet for all his considerable weaknesses, Davis was not as totally guileless or ill-suited to the task as his critics may contend. He grasped the central matter before the Confederacy. Battle. We are, he cried out. "Fighting for our existence, and by fighting alone can independence be gained." He did show a surprising capacity for growth, as evidenced by his dispensing with one brick after another of states' rights if they impeded the war effort, right up to his eventual willingness to grant emancipation to slaves who fought for the Confederacy, thereby dooming the institution itself. And he insisted, rightly so, that secession was not a revolution. Such logic, Davis averred, was an abuse of language. "We left the Union," he thundered, "to save ourselves from a revolution." Indeed, almost 100 years of history had made the Confederacy anything but a complete aberration. The Constitution appeared to be largely on his side, as was tradition, and, some could argue, the larger and much longer historical trend of self-determination that would more fully flower in the century to come. Perhaps most importantly, Davis had guts, and a kind of religious, even mystical belief in his country. But was he now acting like a dreamy madman, as some have said, or a crazy zealot? Did he not sense what was to come? To be sure, he was thin-skinned, humorless, narrow-minded, and at times, fatally unimaginative. Yet somebody had to believe in the Confederacy throughout its darkest hours. In history, nearly all leaders who have given birth to new nations or religious movements or empires or great discoveries were, to one extent or another, fanatical. They had to be. From Julius Caesar to Martin Luther, from Magellan to Napoleon, from Bolivar to Galileo, all these men shared common traits. Stubborn, steel-willed, driven, secretive, fastidious, zealous, short-tempered. Each, in his own way, was a profound dreamer. To a man, each was ultimately prepared to act alone, without encouragement, relying solely on his own inner resolve. Indifferent to approval, reputation, wealth, or even love, they cherished their personal sense of honor, which they allowed no one else to judge. What went wrong, then, in what is perhaps most tragic for Davis personally, though not, of course, for the United States, was that he was on the losing side. We view him accordingly. In his final flight, he never gave up, not until the bitter end. Those last April and then early May days of 1865 were frenetic, tense, harrowing. The pace was excruciating. Throughout, he was often agitated or anxious. But he never complained or lost his composure. He was always dignified. And, as the chase for him grew, so it seems, did his courage. The biggest blow, for which he was wholly unprepared, was Lee's surrender. When he first learned of it, he was in Danville, Virginia, with his cabinet. The message was received like a sharp cuff to the stomach. He and his aides fell deathly silent as the folded note bearing the news passed quietly from hand to hand to hand. In private, Davis later wept. Nonetheless, he was only momentarily fazed by the setback, stubbornly refusing to concede defeat and resolving to fight all the way to the Mississippi. He rapped out the order to keep on moving. Yet after April 15, that task became all the more difficult. He no longer went by train but was escorted by a small band of Tennessee cavalry. Over the course of 30 days, in great heat and through driving rains, with too little sleep and too little nourishment, this 57-year-old man and his shrinking cabinet would cover a startling 400 miles, 320 of them on horseback. 163 miles more than a distance from Washington, D.C. to New York City, 350 more than a trip from Boston, Massachusetts to Providence, Rhode Island, 296 more than from Philadelphia to Baltimore. Davis could withstand the exhaustion, but not so the loss of his generals or the echoing words of Lee calling on him to give up any thought of partisan warfare. On April 19, he learned about Lincoln's assassination. "Certainly, I have no special regard for Mr. Lincoln," he said, "but there are a great many men of whose end I would rather hear than his. I fear it will be disastrous for our people, and I regret it." What he feared even more was Andrew Johnson, whom he regarded as a bitter and vindictive man who, unlike Lincoln, would grossly punish the South. The retreat continued. Then, to Davis's horror, came Johnston's insubordination and surrender on April 26. "I fear the spirit of the people is broken," one Davis aide noted. A disbelieving Davis himself gloomily wrote to his wife, "Panic has seized the country." Actually, by now, the prospects were far bleaker. But despite the harsh judgments of some contemporaries, including Southerners and by scholars, Davis at least deserves his due for this. He was anything but a coward. Now, with a heightened sense of urgency, he and his entourage kept moving.